Welcome in, ladies and gentlemen, to MBR, or as we like to call it around here, Nothing But Rants, the show where I find topics that I'm oddly passionate about, and I pontificate upon them. These are not hot takes, but rather takes that I'm hot about.
Let's shut up and grind some tape.
What is up, ladies and gentlemen? Welcome in to the Film Guy Network on a fabulous Tuesday evening. I gotta tell you what, I don't know what it was. I didn't plan to talk about this to open the show, but I just got like a little inkling that like, I've got season vibes. I don't know if it's because we're in a routine. The boys been around together for a couple weeks together. Like we've been in a routine together. It feels like we're close to the season. Not, we're like 75 days.
Yeah.
80 days.
Something around there.
We're getting there. We're inkling ever so closely to the college football season. But it feels like, you know, we steadily working around here. And we got another loaded show for you guys again tonight. We got the College Football 2026 Hall of Fame ballot to talk about tonight. It was on the show notes last night. We're bringing it back tonight, as was our year three rule. Don't know if you're new to the network. If you are, I'm going to go ahead and tell you, we have a year three rule in college football with regards to coaching. We're going to tell you a little bit more about that tonight. The SEC potentially becoming a league of its own, a guy with a lot of expert analysis in the regards to the business of college football making such comments today. We're going to talk about that as well. Are there any quarterback battles left in the world of college football? That got added to the show notes late because I think it's worth talking about, right? We're nearing the end of the summer where we're nearing SEC media days. We're nearing Big Ten media days. It's about time to start naming the face of your football program entering the season. A couple of big programs still yet to do so. But I want to start the show tonight by asking you to hit that thumbs up button, but really with some nostalgia, because boys, I think there are a few things better than sitting around with the boys and playing a little game I like to call, hey, you remember? For example, hey boys, you remember that time Chris Davis returned 109-yard field goal back to beat Alabama, clinch a BCS national title berth for the Auburn Tigers?
Stopped a three-peat.
That was pretty cool, huh?
That was one of the greatest days in college football history, in my opinion.
There was like, another good game going on?
There was plenty of good. I think people forget that the Ohio State-Michigan game ended in a failed two-point conversion where Michigan would have upset number three Ohio State. Didn't happen. Then you had the 3:30 kick of Georgia versus Georgia Tech. Georgia was down like 20 points in that game, came back to win in double overtime. Then the Auburn-Alabama game, obviously, to stop a three-peat from happening. And then the 7 p.m. nightcap was Missouri versus Texas A&M. A Johnny Manziel-led Texas A&M went down to the wire. They won that game to clinch the East, Missouri did.
Now, I'm sure other sports have this, but there are so many things that went that way for that game to end that way. Like, for example, Alabama had missed several field goals in that football game.
Yep.
And then Saban pulls the freshman from Calhoun up off the bench, who won a state championship game in Georgia with, I think, a 58-yard field goal and lines up for a 57-yard field goal, misses it by
and
an inch.
Before that, initially the time ran out in the ball game.
Yeah,
Nick Saban had it reviewed.
He's fighting for the second
on the clock, gets the second back, and ends up costing
totally
the game.
I forgot about that part, too.
Yeah. I mean, the last, like, 10 seconds of that game took, like, 20 minutes. Because I remember we watched I was watching the Georgia Tech game, and my family was like, oh, shoot, the Iron Bowl is about to go to overtime. There's 3 seconds left. And we watched T.J. Yeldon run the ball out. It took like 20 minutes for that game to end because they spent so long reviewing that to get that 1 second on the board.
And there's a lot of great radio calls. And RIP to Rob Bramblett and him and his wife tragically passed in a car accident. Mm-hmm. But that radio call from that moment, I mean, it encapsulated everything. It was perfect. Now, I haven't gone back and listened to the Bama call recently. I would imagine that doesn't sound as chaotic. But this one, there are so many peaks in that call that are just so legendary. The color analyst hitting the, oh, my God, in the middle of it is legendary. We found out listening to it today, not only does he hit a, oh, my God, but you can hear a second one. And he's, you can't hear it clearly because he's very obviously taking his headset off, going to absolutely lose his mind. He continues to come back to the microphone about 50 seconds later, only saying "Oh my God" again, because it was nothing but an "Oh my God" moment. There was also the moment where Bramlett hits the "Auburn's going to win the football game." There's just so many great calls in that moment. That's a tremendous play and college football moment.
And the portion in the call where it's very clear that he is about to black out from screaming for the entire 109 yards, where it's like, you're getting super lightheaded. You can't see anything.
By the moment he hits the dismount of they're not going to be able to keep him off the field tonight, he sounds like he has a whole ass frog in his throat. There is no doubt about that.
Definitely running low on oxygen.
Oh, yeah. About to pass out.
I think another one that doesn't usually get enough credit, Appalachian State's field goal block against Michigan. Michigan was like the number one team in the country at that time of the year. So, like, an insane upset to begin the season. One of the more iconic plays. One of the first plays I remember consciously watching as a kid, being like, oh, wow, feeling the moment of that win.
I don't think there's been a smoother scoop and score in the history of scoop and scores.
It wasn't a scoop and score.
No, but he picks it off the foot, and as the ball's bouncing, he picks it up full stride and takes it to the crib.
No, he didn't.
On the block field goal, doesn't he?
He didn't score. He got tackled.
Oh.
But it was
it's a great scoop is what I'm saying. On the run, ball bouncing, give me that.
Yeah.
Not as good and a favorable as bounce as like the Alec Ogletree play. Yeah. That thing just like magnetically fell into his hands.
Yeah, like he ran into that ball.
This guy actually had a scoop one. Now, Caleb Downs' scoop and score this year was nuts. That dude picked one up off his shoelaces. Yes. No bounce.
Yeah, you don't ever.
That ball's rolling.
You don't ever realize how hard it is to do that running full speed until you do
until you try.
And then you look foolish most of the time.
Or worse, fall on your face.
Yeah.
Like, I guarantee you the average Joe falling on your face. Ball rolling, not ball bouncing. Ball rolling. Really, really hard to pick up.
It's the equivalent of being in the outfield in baseball, and you go to scoop a ball up.
Listen. You got 14 inches on a glove.
Exactly. That's even more of a reason why you should never miss it. And then you have to turn around and run to the entire fence, just knowing everybody's like, what an idiot. That guy sucks at baseball.
I thought you were saying the ease of it or the difficulty of it. Way harder to pick up a football that's rolling on the ground than have a glove on your hand.
I agree with that.
Baseball.
Same feeling, though, of ball rolling to the fence because missed it.
Oh, shit.
Dang, I got to make this run now.
No doubt about that.
Do you remember the trouble with the snap, Michigan State versus Michigan?
Oh, yeah.
Tom Lugenbaugh had like 17 voice, like the most egregious voice cracks.
The stories in this are great because obviously there's that. There's the voice cracks. The call is iconic. I went back and looked at the game log for this game. Michigan State had 8 drives in this game that either ended in a punt or a turnover on downs. Michigan, eight drives ended in a punt or a turnover on downs. Michigan was completely shutting them down for most of the football game.
Big Ten football, baby.
Yeah.
I showed you a clip the other day of Kirk Ferentz taking a safety up 6-2 against Penn State. Now, he took the safety on a 4th-and-7, Kirby, okay, to make the game 6-4. How much time do you think was left in that football game for that coach to make that decision?
How much time should have been left? Less than 30 seconds. How much time was probably left? Like 3 minutes.
How about 8.5?
Jesus.
How about 8.5 minutes left in the fourth quarter?
I've also never understood the let's just take a safety.
I mean, sometimes it's
you're
I
giving them the ball
mathematically.
After.
Sometimes it makes sense to do so with almost 9 minutes left in the football game.
Yeah.
They won it 6-4.
How does it make
absurd?
How does it make more sense mathematically to do that than just give them the football?
I think because you're risking a punt block that goes back for a touchdown
instead
of a safety.
Okay, that's fine. They score a touchdown, but then you're still giving them the football back plus 2 points.
But if there's 30 seconds left, mathematically they're not going to move the ball down in the scoring
and you're
position.
Getting better field position for your defense as opposed to getting a really good punt. They still might end up on like the other 40-yard
line. Speaking
of
giving it away, hey, remember that time that Michigan was like gifted a 4th-and-1 that was like obviously noticeably short, and for some reason they marked it forward. For those of you that don't remember, this is a 2013 Outback game, and Jadeveon Clowney took such offense that he murdered a man on the next play.
This is the definition of ball don't lie.
Oh my God! Definition of football, ball don't lie.
I mean, the announcer even called it too. He's like, South Carolina deserves to have it, and they do.
Yeah,
yeah.
Like just the prime example of ball don't lie.
My favorite part about that play is I to this day believe Jadeveon Clowney is going to scoop that ball up one hand and take it off to the end zone if his teammates aren't spazzing out.
Oh.
His teammates are spazzing that
he
because
picked
of
it
the
up
hits,
like a Nerf ball.
Like a Nerf ball. Yeah. Like an avatar with like 3 fingers, like from the tip, not like middle of the ball. Like grabbed the tip of it and scooped it up into his elbow. And like I said, his teammates are trying to celebrate so much because he just murdered a man that they tackle him basically.
Yeah.
Or else he's definitely taking that back to the house. What a play.
Do you guys remember that 2015 Arkansas-Ole Miss game where Ole Miss is in the driver's seat to win the West, and Arkansas is like, it's like 4th and 17. They throw a hitch route, and the guy throws it 20 yards downfield.
Is this Hunter Henry?
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Yes,
running
it
back
is.
Picks
and Alex
it up.
Collins, right?
Yes, RIP. Mm. Alex Collins picks it up, converts a fourth down, eventually forces overtime where Arkansas wins. One of the craziest games I've ever seen.
They were Lane Kiffening before Lane Kiffin was even there.
Oof.
Ooh. Who was the head coach at that point? That was Hugh Freeze, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, yeah, that would have been Hugh Freeze time.
Shame here.
Or the scapegoat, Matt Luke. One or the other.
How about the famous Lamar leap?
Ooh, yeah.
This was like, for me, I just like watching this game because this was one of the rare occasions.
Man, basically, it wasn't even a leap. It was like a toe touch over a dude.
Oh, yeah. And it was a great football game. But on top of that, like, this is what I remember. I was like remembering thinking like, oh, he just won the Heisman. That's what that moment felt like. We always talk about.
That was
about,
like week two as well.
I know, but it just seemed like that. Like, that was a great football game. And the fact that I thought he
won the Heisman after he put up 63 on a top 10 Florida State.
There were probably multiple Heisman moments throughout that year.
Lamar Jackson was fun to watch back in the day.
Yeah, he was. I was fascinated. I was covering the NFL draft at that time. It was like way back. It's before I got my start covering Georgia. And I just remember being fascinated with the discussion of real smart people, or at least people that we thought were smart at the time, talking about him playing anything other than quarterback and saying that he was like unable to throw from the pocket. And he made big time throws at Louisville from the pocket, I thought, the entire time. It wasn't just all the flash. There was a lot of flash. But you don't win a Heisman and throw for 3,900 yards. Without a lot of work from the pocket.
And he obviously made
a
lot.
If that hits 3,900 yards, I am flabbergasted.
3,600. You're close.
But he clearly made a lot of conscious efforts to advance his in pocket passing
throughout that. You got one?
Other than that, like, I feel like that's probably the two that stick out to me.
Hey, boys,
most.
You remember that time Miami lateraled like 27 times on the final kickoff of the game to beat Duke?
Should not have counted.
Yeah, probably shouldn't. I watched it today. There were, first of all, 8 laterals in that play. Fun fact, top 5 name in terms of like, really? Corn Elder not only catches that kickoff, but is also the last one in the lateral to catch it and score. I think that's pretty cool about that play. There's also multiple blocks in the back. There's also multiple forward laterals. I think it was one of those, and we've had many of these moments in college football where the shit was just so cool that the zebras just looked at each other and was like,
yeah,
I guess we're going to let that go?
Right? Like being a referee, probably like you're so enthralled and like, this shit's still going. Like, oh, wait, I probably should call some penalty.
It was just a reminder to me that Miami's been doing this shit for a long time. It wasn't just this past season where they've been gifted these moments. Like, it's been happening for years.
My favorite part about that call.
Is this retribution for the Ohio State call?
Probably. My favorite part about that call is the very beginning, the first pitch, the play announcer goes, "We saw them practice this on Thursday." I'm like, wow. Bro, Manny Diaz is out here. Bro, he thought he was coach of the year after that. He was like, we definitely worked on that.
I told the boys on Thursday.
It might come down to the old schoolyard bullshit.
You know what's another one that doesn't get talked about enough?
What's
2015
that?
Florida State, top 10 team. They're tied with Georgia Tech, 16-16. They're going to kick a game-winning field goal. Field goal gets blocked. Georgia Tech returns it for a touchdown. One of those like underrated plays, I felt like no one really talks about it as much. Like, I don't think it was on a top 25 list either.
Was that one of those seasons though where Florida State started in the top 10 and then ended up fizzling out towards the end of
the year? This was the latter years of the Jimbo Fisher era where it was like, and you could point that back to being like the start of the downfall.
Yeah,
for them. I mean, like they were undefeated at that point.
Y'all remember that time Ed Reed stripped his own teammate? I wasn't a pick for a touchdown.
I wasn't old enough to watch it live, but I do remember seeing the highlights of it.
So when my mind remembered that play today, I thought it was like, oh, obviously the big D lineman's getting tackled. As he's getting tackled, Ed goes over there, rips the ball from him. No, Ed Reed was very clearly making the decision as soon as that guy breaks into open field, I'm going to strip my own teammate. And then he returns it for a touchdown. Other really cool things looking at that video, that AstroTurf, my God, that was basically piece of carpet that they rolled out there mm-hmm. over concrete slab.
Mm-hmm.
Dudes were out there playing in like, you know those baseball trainers they give you for team issues? Mm-hmm. I don't know if y'all play baseball. But they have like turfers that you play with. That's what dudes were playing football mm-hmm. with out back in the day. I know we got some older heads in the chat that are probably going to recall that time period of football, but that was nuts.
Yeah, I'm glad I skipped that era of football.
I do too. That probably would have been crazy. Speaking of other remembers, y'all remember that time Teddy Bridgewater almost died?
Yes.
Dude,
John Bostic
yes.
murdered him
this is
in a bowl game.
Another prime example of just like pre-targeting football to mm-hmm. where guys were just running through heads down.
Ooh, you think that one was bad? Speaking of pre-targeting, we watched one today. My man Reggie Brown died. My man Reggie Brown died yeah. against Auburn one year.
Yes, he did.
And it was so bad that like he's like unconscious on the field. And this is such an era of football where the PA announcer's like, that's so-and-so. So-and-so had an illegal hit earlier in the game, but that one's clean there.
Like the blatant
dude, there's
target.
A dead body on the field.
Blatant. Like there is a man unconscious on the field right now.
And it was worse because, you know, typically they end up falling
you
on their
back.
You
were introduced to this today.
Well,
you?
reintroduced to
this
but
today.
But, yeah, the fact that he was facing down on the ground and not moving, like it yeah. literally looked like.
There's a dead body on the field.
Yeah, someone had just.
Matt Ryan died one time.
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
I don't remember that one.
Oh,
I mean, I've probably seen
Matt
it.
Ryan got moited.
I mean,
at Boston College,
that clip is like the definition of Matt Ryan's career. Of like, I just got to put my life on the line for us to win.
You ever seen the Tom Brady clip where he gets murdered on the sideline?
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
very akin to that.
Oh, okay,
except
okay.
he takes a direct spear to the sternum.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
Yeah, back when spearing was cool, allowed.
Back when Edge was still in the WWE.
Facts, WWF at that time. Yeah.
No, WWF ended like the late 90s.
No. WWF spear. The spear football, WWF.
Okay.
WWE, total different. Start targeting.
What?
So we have a theory around here. Make sure you hit that thumbs up button, like, subscribe, rate, review, all that good stuff. We have a theory around here that by the third year of your coaching career as a head coach at any given school, we know who you are, or at least we think we are. History tells us that you're either going to reach what you're going to be or you're not. And Dabo checked this box. Kirby checked this box. Nick Saban checked this box twice. Okay, there's a lot of football coaches in years prior. Ryan Day's probably not this. Okay, he didn't win a national title within
but
3 years.
But he had successes.
But like, he was having success.
You win the Big
3 10 years.
And you go to the playoffs.
Yeah. Dan Lanning has reached 3-year checkpoint. Okay, Steve Sarkisian has checked this box within 3 years, right? You get the point. Within 3 years, you should have built the program up to a winnable standard if you're going to be that guy at that program. So we've got some football coaches that are already or are up for the year 3 test. For example, Kenny Dillingham has already passed the year 3 test, has gotten Arizona State to a winnable rate, already made a playoff in year 2. Jeff Brohm, we believe on this network, has gotten Louisville to a you're winning at the highest rate Louisville provides. We think you're good there. Jeff Brohm checking that box. Did so already at Purdue, by the way. That's why he's mm-hmm. at Louisville, his alma mater. Barry Odom checked this box at UNLV to the point where he's now at Purdue. Okay, some coaches who have already failed the year 3 test. We have already cooked Zach Arnett at Mississippi State.
Yeah.
We have already cooked Ryan Walters at Purdue. I cover college football for a living. Did y'all know Ryan Walters was a coach at Purdue?
No.
That's on me. Did you?
No.
Did you, AI? AI didn't even know. What? AI didn't even know.
I can't name one Purdue player other than Aiden O'Connell right now.
I didn't even know he played at Purdue.
Card?
Oh, QB Whisper. I should have known that. That's right.
Raider too.
Troy Taylor, been fired at Stanford, and show legend Biff Poge, already been fired
at
Charlotte. I think it was a mutual disagreement. I'm going to go back to managing my wealth fund. That's worth, I think, $100 million.
I do miss the takes last year, though. Biff yeah. Poge did give us a lot of good
content.
Oh, the content
that Poge provide, man. Hmm.
R.I.P.
R.I.P. So, let's talk about some guys who are heading into year 3 that's still up for debate or discussion, rather, with whether or not they've checked this box. Starting with a local program here in the state, Brent Key with them Yellow Jackets. I'm not calling them Blue Jackets. With them Yellow Jackets. What do you think about Brent Key heading into year 3? Where's he at? Is he one at the rate where we feel good about Brent Key at Georgia Tech?
You definitely feel like Georgia Tech's in the right direction, especially like having such a hard time getting out of the Paul Johnson era. Like, it feels like Georgia Tech has its own identity once again, and especially with what they did last year. Like, there were some ups, there were some downs, but you take a playoff team, a Georgia playoff team that you haven't beaten in seven seasons to eight overtimes like that, and should have beat them, honestly. Like, you
5-0 at home. Get them boys the rings.
Yeah, I mean, they beat a top five Miami team. Like, they got rings.
Beat a top 10 Florida State team.
I'm shocked they didn't put almost beat
they
Georgia.
They were ranked that when they beat them.
That was on the ring.
It was on the ring.
We can't make fun of that 2-10 win. That was on the ring.
Yeah, the rings question.
7-5 championship rings. I you know what?
7-6.
I'm down with it. 7-6. I'm okay with it.
You're down with it?
I mean, you got to have something to commemorate the season, and you got FU money, so yeah, just go ahead and get the boys some rings. I'm sure, who's that company that comes by and gives you your school rings?
Boston's.
I'm sure they give out your cheap rings. I mean, shit, this one couldn't have cost but a couple, you know, $75, $85 at wholesale. You know what I mean? You print 150 of them bitches. They can't be that expensive.
Put it on a t-shirt or a poster then. Don't make freaking rings.
Nah, not as cool. Not as cool.
Yeah, because it's not cool.
It ain't real bling.
Well, I know.
It ain't real diamond.
Surely none of them are actually rocking them.
Yeah, well, I don't know.
You can't be rocking that.
Nah, you rock that when you put the suits on. That's about the only time you wear a championship ring.
Come on, man.
I don't think you ever fired Brent Key for one reason. He played there. He loves that school. He's never leaving.
And the fact
that he's there. He's like, you're good. Brent Key forever.
And you had the experience with – Jeff Collins or Geoff Collins. You had that experience, and you saw – and look, I know he was coming after the Paul Johnson era, so that's a really tough time
to build that
program back up, to completely renovate a roster, basically, is what you're doing with that. But, I mean, he's had more success at that program than that program has seen in a long time, even if it is. No,
I mean, I don't think old Geoff gonna get another crack at it, but that was a tough run for him.
Yeah,
right there,
it was.
Man. That was a tough spot
when they were like they're lifting before the game. Like
he was trying everything. They
may or may not have seen old Geoff on my coaching tour. Mm. Yeah.
Oh,
still rocking the coffee mug, not Waffle House, but he's still rocking the coffee. It was like 82 degrees, sun out, just hot the day I was out there with him. And he was rocking the coffee mug.
Some people love coffee, man.
Nice guy. Knows ball. Who's next? We're good on Brent Key, though.
I'm good on him.
He's checked the box for the. He's passed year three test.
He's already passed it. It's not like he's accelerated like a Nick Saban or a Kirby Smart has, but he's fine.
What if he turns a 6-6 this year?
They'll start raising some questions about him. I mean, you turned 7-5 last year.
I think are we going down? We're mediocre. We're flatlining.
It depends on if there's if in those six wins, there's a top 15 upset.
I'm going to tell you right now, if they're on their path to 6-6, Aaron Filo is already starting.
That's true.
That's the other thing. If you're not watching Georgia Tech football, which most of you guys probably aren't, I think Aaron Filo is a dude. I think Aaron Filo is going to be an NFL football player. I just don't know when he's going to take over that spot of Hanks King, because Hanks King's a great college football player, but Filo is going to be a dude in the NFL, I think. Up next, Matt Rhule. Now, this is a guy who's put his own year three thing on the line. He's done set it. I turned it around at Temple within 3 years. I turned it around at Baylor within 3 years. I'm going to do it here at Nebraska.
You would think that it's trending that way, I guess. We can all agree that Nebraska took a step forward last year from where they were, but how big was that step? How monumental was it? Did you put yourself in enough of a position to take another step to be a top 25 team this year?
Did they, though? Because, I think people forget that it's not like Scott Frost got fired for being 3-10. Scott Frost got fired for losing close games and being 7-6, didn't he?
The one score game man himself.
Mm. I mean, look at Nebraska's game logs from last year. Are they still not losing one score games, just in a different fashion?
They lost to Illinois by a score. They got killed by Indiana. They lost to Ohio State by a score. They lost to UCLA by a score. They lost to USC by a score. Lost to Iowa by a score. Like, it's the one score thing, yes, but
I think what we're looking at is Scott Frost got shitty PR and he got good PR. Also, Scott Frost did that in the Big 12. You're doing this in the Big 10.
They did start 5-1, though.
And, well, actually, Scott Frost is doing that in the Big Ten West, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you can't be doing that.
Northwestern.
No.
Damn, you've boys, Northwestern got us this week.
Yeah,
it's more important.
Yeah, Northwestern got us in Ireland that one time.
Yeah, can't have that. Can't have that.
It's more important that Nebraska sees, like the where they have placed assets to where they see benefit, they benefit from those. Like Dylan Raiola, he's going to be going into year two. You got Danke on the roster as well at wide receiver. They made some moves on their roster this past offseason and obviously have recruited specific players where you expect them to take steps forward. You have to see that this year because not only is it year three for them, for Matt Rhule, but it's also multiple years now.
I want to do this because I did this to you yesterday in the studio. We didn't get to talk about it during the show. You think Matt Rhule's bar for success is 10 wins?
This year?
I'm just talking about if I ask Matt Rhule, what does a successful season in Nebraska look like? It's 10 wins. Would you say?
I'd say probably 8 or 9.
Because his bar for it would be to make a playoff. Mm-hmm. And to do that in the Big Ten, you got to win 10 games.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Easier to win 10 games at Temple or Baylor or Nebraska?
Baylor or
right?
Temple.
And
Baylor.
Temple. He did that at those – I think it's easier to do what he did at Temple – and Baylor than to do what he's trying to do at Nebraska. Does that make sense?
It's definitely going to be a more elongated process.
I mean, it's way hard. It's going to take way longer to close the gap on Ohio State and Michigan than it did to close the gap on whoever he had to close the gap in the Atlantic and close the gap on whatever there is a gap in Big 12. There's not.
Well, I think right
in the
now.
The Big 12, there isn't a gap. There never has been, don't think. And I think Texas was there.
I think right now the priority is close the gap on Nebraska or close the gap on the Iowas and things like that. The second tier teams.
That. They've done that.
That's what I'm saying.
They've got to close the gap on – they got to pass USC.
You want
to
be –
close the gap on USC maybe.
And to his credit, lost to USC by one score, lost to Ohio State by one score, lost to UCLA by one score, killed Wisconsin. Like, there's proof of concept there that the gap is closing. Like, they're no longer just getting smashed by all these teams. They got killed by Indiana. But it's also like, you hold Ohio – you hold the national championship Ohio State team to 21 points, lose by four. That's a pretty good season for you.
Yeah, I think that their goal should be what – not exactly a blueprint of what Indiana did last season, but that's what you want to try and be is – you feel like you're on the outside looking in, but you somehow find a way to get into the mix. Now, the only difference there is that Nebraska needs to sustain that. It can't just be a one-year blimp on the radar, and that was it, like a one-trick pony. It has to be like, all right, now we have arrived. Close the gap on a school like Penn State, who we say is the third-best team typically in that conference. That's what you need to try and chase down.
Boys, is Luke Fickell cooked?
Yeah, I think Luke
Fickell. We're entering year three at Wisconsin. You know, I'm the guy who year one on this show, going into year one of Luke Fickell in the Big Ten.
By the way, Justice Fitzpatrick just shut down his commitment, so I'm going to write that.
Appreciate you. That's good news for the University of Georgia right there. Told you. Well, I mean, we talked about that last night. Ain't nothing to worry about there. Anyways, what were we talking about?
Luke Fickell.
You're talking about Luke Fickell year one.
Yeah. I remember him going into Wisconsin year one, and they were still in the Big Ten West. And I verbatim on this show said, I think Luke Fickell could coach a Division II roster in the Big Ten West and win 7 games.
Yeah, I remember you saying that.
He coached that Wisconsin roster in the Big Ten West to a 6-6 record, I think, year one. Not great. It wasn't great last year either. And what baffled me about Luke Fickell, and I wish Luke, and we'll never be this show because we say things like this, which means coaches will never come on here and ask questions like this. Coach, what in the hell made you go from a very balanced offense with Desmond Ridder at Cincinnati, like no gimmicks to it, like pro style almost, but out of the gun? I think they mixed in a lot of pistol from what I remember studying them, to being like, oh yeah, I'm going to air raid this bitch. Like, you've never been an air raid guy. You're a defensive-minded football coach, by the way, and you're going to take over the air raid, a total different system change. That was weird to me. Also, you dominated with an odd front defense at Cincinnati, played 3-3-5 with a lot of cover three behind it, and then you get to Wisconsin and you don't do that. If you would have told me, leaving with Cincinnati, that Luke Fickell was basically going to change everything about himself as a football coach and going to Wisconsin, I would have said, yeah, probably not going to work out. Weird. Yeah. Totally, I adopted a totally different philosophy as a football coach at a bigger job, where I would argue it's harder to air raid, way harder to air raid in the Big Ten to win at a high level of football than it is to win it in the, what were they, the Atlantic again, the AAC with Cincinnati? At the time, they were a mid-major school.
I feel like the timeline is really unfortunate for Luke Fickell because, like, for example,
they gave him the Venables fake raise, by the way. Fake extension. They gave
him
the Finch.
Yeah. Do you think, though, that if Fickell knew that college football was going to be what it was today and Cincinnati, of course, was going to go to the Big 12, do you think he stays there?
Well, he's an Ohio guy, right? He played at Ohio State.
That's actually a good question.
Yeah, that's a really good question.
Because, like,
you would have been, well, I thought Cincinnati was going to roll into the Big 12 and do good things, but Scott Satterfield, we're going to talk about him in a second.
Yeah.
Ain't necessarily off to a good start out there in the Big 12.
Plus, it's, no, not really.
Not, it's not only just running the air raid, too, but it's you're running the air raid with Tyler Van Dyke. Like, that's who we're trusting to throw the ball 40 times a game and win us football games. That's very questionable to be. So it's not only the fact that that's what you're trying to implement. You're going away from what you were at Cincinnati, but the personnel that you're using it with just doesn't quite make sense to me either. But I kind of, like I said, I kind of do believe that hindsight 2020, I think Luke Fickell would have just wrote it out at Cincinnati.
Speaking of Cincinnati, Scott Satterfield entering year three, currently 8-16 at Cincy. That job might be open this fall. Speaking of which, Brian Hartline, automatic hire.
Yeah.
You heard it here first. Right now, June 10th, 2025, on the Film Guy Network, Brian Hartline will be the next head coach of Cincinnati. It just makes too much sense, right, boys?
Yeah, and that's kind of why it's like, is it going to happen? But at the
also,
same time.
Also, little subtext here. Brian Hartline definitely, like, fake interviewed. Like, I'm just going to do it to get my feet wet in the interview process at Toledo last year. I just got the inkling this is going to happen. But it's got to go decently as an OC this year.
Yeah, you can't have Ohio.
You can't
have Ryan Day say, give me the keys.
Or maybe you could. Maybe you could. And you could just go into Cincy and be like, hey,
you want good receivers?
You want to recruit? I got you, baby.
Yeah, can't have Ryan Day telling you to hold the
light. If you're Cincy, you can't say no to Brian Hartline after Scott Satterfield flamed out, can you?
I don't think so. I mean, you're certainly in less of a position to do so.
I just think that's a decent little tinfoil hat. Get in there early, way early. No one's cornering that one. How about Hugh Freeze? Speaking of the corner.
We've talked about him, I feel like, more than any other year three coach.
Hey, you got to win six games this year.
If that's the benchmark.
Hey, we got to go bowling.
That's it.
So print the headlines, print the shirts. Eli Drinkowitz style. Auburn, got to go bowling. Says your head coach, who you pay $9 million a year to.
Six wins, that's all we need.
Maybe 8.5.
So, but, I mean, Hugh Freeze can say it needs to be six wins, but I don't agree with that. I don't think any of us agree with that, that the benchmark for this roster this year should be six wins. I think they're better than six wins.
Now, if in those six wins you beat a Georgia or an Alabama or whoever else is going to inevitably in their a top 15 opponent that they play, people might kind of start believing in you. The problem with Hugh Freeze is not only has Auburn been really bad, they haven't had a signature win like since he's gotten there. They got really close to beating Georgia in 23. We all know what happened in 23 against Alabama, the grave digger, but there hasn't been the signature Hugh Freeze win that is needed to kind of build the momentum around the program, in my opinion.
Let's just hypothetically say he goes out to Waco to start the season. And my man Sawyer drops 500 on the head top. My man Sawyer Robinson and them Baylor Bears just run amok on that Auburn Tiger defense. And they lose by two scores.
Not a good start.
It's going to be very ugly.
Then they get Ball State, South Alabama.
Okay.
Winnable.
Mm-hmm.
Well, except those
they should win.
Several times they've lost mid-major home games under Hugh Freeze.
Yeah, but that's the Diego Pavia thing.
There's that. At Oklahoma, at A&M, back-to-back. Oh, and then we get a bye week, but we welcome Georgia to town.
Okay.
Do we see eight wins in this schedule is what I'm trying to do,
eight
by
wins,
the way.
No.
Because that's apparently chat says fan base says eight wins mandatory. Missouri, we'll give you that one. Arkansas, we'll give you that one.
Mm-hmm.
Kentucky, we'll give you that one.
Mm-hmm.
Vandy. At Vandy, look, I'm not buying 2 years of competitive Vandy. Are you?
No.
I'm just going to go ahead and get that one out. I'm not buying 2 years of competitive Vandy. There's
buying,
no way.
I'm buying 2 years of scrappy Vandy.
You are.
Scrappy Vandy.
Watch out for Vandy. But see, 2 years in a row? You think that's possible? If it is, Clark Lee's out.
This is why I'm not buying.
I know he played there, but he's out.
This is why I'm not buying it, because I think that what benefited Vanderbilt the most last year wasn't the fact that it was one of their better seasons and they had better players. It was the element of surprise, almost. The fact that nobody was expecting Vanderbilt to be this scrappy football team that could upset Alabama.
To get to 8-4, Auburn absolutely 100% has to win these games. Baylor, Ball State, South Alabama, Missouri, Arkansas, Kentucky, Vanderbilt, and Mercer.
Typical SEC school playing Mercer.
That's toss-up games at Oklahoma, A&M, Georgia, and Alabama. That's doable. That schedule's not that hard. I'm with the Auburn fan base. They might be demanding 8 wins. Basically, what I just said is, Coach, you have to be able to beat Baylor, Kentucky, and Vandy.
Better do it.
You better be able to do that. And Mercer, excuse me. And you better be able to do that.
That's kind of what I was going to get at your point, Kirby, of like, let's say Auburn does beat Georgia and does beat Alabama this year, but they win 6 games. They go 6-6. That also means that there's a high likelihood that you also lost to Kentucky, or you also lost to Vanderbilt, or you also lost to Baylor. And we just watched an Alabama football team that beat Georgia, that beat LSU last season, but none of that mattered because you lost to Vanderbilt, and then you also got the crap beat into you by Oklahoma.
Honestly, Kirby, you hit something there. He has no signature win. That's crazy.
Yeah, no, that is.
He doesn't. And that's kind of what
you didn't even
need.
Put the boys together for one good run.
You almost had him.
Two quarters against Georgia?
Yeah.
I mean, you were beating him in the fourth.
Oh, yeah. He had everything but the Hail Mary against Bama. Mm-hmm. He had them boys.
He beat Bama. You should have beat Bama.
Yeah.
You should have beaten Bama, dude.
Yeah.
A fourth in, what, 32 and you lose that game?
Yes.
That's the more defining – that's the defining game for Hugh Freeze right now. Like, we're that close and we never –
couldn't even blame a bounce of the ball on that one either.
Yeah, if he goes 7-5 with, like, a random inexplicable loss to a Cal, or like he did last year, or to a, for God's sakes, Ball State –
Which is why you might – I think it's why he's out here going like, bowl game, everyone. We just need a bowl game. We just need 6 wins.
Crazy to me, a coach tempering expectations like that.
Yeah.
I understand it, but I don't. I don't for the life of me. Normally we're talking standards, national championship standards.
And it's weird because, like, if you look at Auburn's roster, it's not like they have these massive holes anywhere. Like if you go look at the roster, to me, it's like, that's a good, solid SEC roster. Outside of quarterback. Quarterback is still kind of a question because I don't love the Jackson Arnold move. Like, I don't think that's a guy that's going to walk in and elevate your roster. We saw how that went at Oklahoma. And then, but once you get past that, it's Deuce Knight. And that's another story, though. Mm-hmm. But this year, heading in this year, I feel like everything else around that is pretty solid.
All right, we saved him for last because there's a lot of news around him right now. Deion Sanders entering year three. And I guess we don't even need to talk about whether – has it been a success? Have we already – like, from a financial standpoint,
it's a win. Deion Sanders is the exception to this rule because as long as Colorado is always meaningful. In first take and all those things, you can pile together
does
a
Colorado football
record.
Matter? Check. The box was checked out there, Colorado. We're not talking about Colorado annually demanding 9 wins.
No.
That's not what this
is. I'd say the fact that Deion Sanders is still the head coach of that football program makes that a win.
Well, that's the news. He is currently not with the team, an undisclosed illness. And I guess we can leave it at that.
But write it down in an envelope and put it.
The take?
We'll save it for later.
Is this another retirement take?
No, this is a might be in – give us
we
like,
– don't even, we don't even have to –
maybe sit on this one for like a month.
Oh.
Maybe even longer.
We going to tee longer? The season give, off with give, the Deion Sanders take?
Give this a year. Let this bake for a
Let
year
this bake.
Before we go, all right, we were right. Because it's a touchy subject. Obviously, we wish Deion Sanders the best health. But you could raise some eyebrows around it in certain situations. And I don't think you should because we don't know anything right now.
Especially
but.
When it comes to health concerns.
Exactly.
I mean, man had a foot, like, toes cut off. Like, mm-hmm. he's obviously had real medical concerns in years prior. But we're stowing a retirement take. Okay. It's going to go up on the board.
Are you tacking it up the board?
Yeah, I'm going to tack this one on the board. I think we lost the last one.
No. Oh. Don't worry. I remember it.
It's on the board. We'll get to that one day, maybe. Maybe. It's not my take either. It was texted to me today by a listener who actually, I shouldn't give too much info away. It'll give his identity out. Long-time listener. First time take theft. guys, there's a Hall of Football fame or a Hall of Fame list coming out. There's a ballot. Mm-hmm. Y'all want to play ballot games?
Let's play ballot games.
We get nostalgic on this one. What I think it would be hard is if you made it like only 10 guys can get in. And I think there are 10 surefire Hall of Famers this year on the ballot. I'll go down the list. Dez Bryant, Aaron Donald, RG3, Percy Harvin, Mark Ingram, James Laurinaitis, Kellen Moore, Cam Newton, Monte Teau, Ndamukong Suh. I believe that's all of those guys' first years on the ballot, and I think those guys are guaranteed to be Hall of Famers.
What's the parameters to getting put on the ballot?
Every other ballot's like 5 years after retirement. So it can't be Laurinaitis' first year.
Years after like retirement from the sport in general?
Yeah.
Because Cam Newton hasn't played in college in 15 years.
So it might be 5 years post-retirement.
Maybe. I don't know.
Surely Cam Newton has not been on this ballot very long.
I know for a fact
it's Aaron Donald's first time on
That's why I'm kind of confused, because it's like,
and he hasn't been retired for 5 years.
No, I don't know when they put these guys on here. That's a great question, and I don't know if you're going to find an answer to it.
I don't
even know if AI's got an answer to that one.
Yeah, AI might not have the answer to that one.
I don't even know when you get put on the ballot. What do you got?
It says AI got it right here. It says 10 years. After the last college football season.
No.
Interesting.
Years.
So why wasn't Cam Newton on the ballot 5 years ago?
It's a great question.
That's like, what took y'all so long?
Maybe they had to close an investigation.
That could be it.
Maybe it took 5 years to close an investigation.
That could be.
You know, there was a daddy might have taken some money situation there.
This is true.
Scam Newton.
There was going to say, the nickname Scam Newton wasn't unwarranted.
Correct.
There were some speculations, allegedly. But no, I mean, Cam Newton, obviously, first ballot Hall of Famer.
Who just said that? What are y'all talking about?
That's AI, bro. What are you talking
about?
Artificial intelligence built
Mom installed AI in the basement. It's pretty sweet.
Thanks, Mom. Shout out to Mom Dukes there.
Yeah, I mean, Cam Newton, obviously, this had, like, first ballot.
You know who's still on the ballot?
Who?
I didn't even realize this until I looked at it today. Taylor Mays was a three-time All-American at USC. You remember Taylor Mays?
Really?
You might be too young for Taylor Mays.
I don't know.
I didn't watch.
Nobody Google Taylor Mays.
Taylor Mays is like a pro. He looked like the Fox NFL logo.
Taylor Mays looks like the football. Yes, the Fox player logo is a great pull. I was going to say the guy you create on NCAA when you jack the muscles all the way up.
Like Taylor Mays, USC.
I could have sworn Taylor Mays was going to be the greatest safety in the history of professional football. And did he flame out. My God. What do you think of Taylor Mays' photos? That dude's jacked.
Yeah, he's a big boy.
Just looks like a classic early 2000s
Kirby,
safety.
You're hip to the performance enhancers, I would imagine. Do you think that was a possibility he was on some shit?
And when
he got to the league, the testing was a little bit stiffer, and he couldn't take the shit no more?
Well, here's the problem with that theory. Brian Cushing existed like 10 years after Taylor Mays.
That's true.
And Cush was on that shit.
Cush might have invented horse tranquilizer.
Maybe, dude. Yeah. I don't know. So maybe, I don't know. Like, there's also just like some skills don't translate as well. Like we've knocked on Pac-12 football. Also.
How is Richard Seymour not a college football Hall of Famer?
That's something I've also, like, you're an NFL Hall, and maybe his college career just wasn't that.
He was a one-time All-American, I think.
Mm-hmm. I mean, he had a great Georgia career, but it wasn't like the meat of his career took place when he was in the NFL. So maybe that's what it is.
Jonathan Vilma.
Also, I don't remember Vilma personally from college, but obviously a very, very...
Yeah, I just know him as a saint.
Prominent.
Yeah, same thing with Marshawn Lynch. I mean, we had the one clip of him running around a cow, but it wasn't on the cart. But it wasn't like you remember... Like, I don't, as a child, remember Marshawn Lynch clips at cow. Do y'all?
Yeah, but I don't remember Aaron Rodgers clips either.
Well, he played there a year after coming from community college. So it wasn't like he was a lifer at Cal. This dude spent 3 years.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Building a real draftable record there.
Me?
Yeah.
Let me put you on game real quick.
Thanks, man. Sorry.
You guys working over there?
Yeah. I'm trying to work while we're working on air.
Eric Weddle, Utah.
Again, Noah mostly for his time on the Chargers, one with the Rams. Didn't really watch him at Utah. Wasn't he a part of that?
Rice was a two-time All-American.
Yeah. Wasn't Eric Weddle a part of that undefeated Utah team that beat Alabama that 1 year?
That means he would have been playing with Steve Smith, and I don't think that's the case.
Maybe. I don't know.
Right? Didn't Steve Smith win a bunch of games at Utah?
Yes.
Wasn't he on that undefeated
team? I'm pretty sure it was 2009 when Utah went undefeated, or 2010, the 2010 season maybe. Thank you, J-Will.
You're welcome.
Who else is on the list?
Fugger's in the chat. Shout out to Fugger. He showed back up. Daily reminder that the SEC runs through Texas.
Well.
I think I'd remember that more. No.
No, finish it.
I was going to say, I think I'd remember that more with the $2 you usually send us. It might help emphasize the $2.
Yeah.
Come on,
Yeah, you're right. You're right. I shouldn't even point to that until he pays for me to point to that.
Yeah, I feel like I remember Texas a little more.
You know what? It would be befitting of that Longhorns football program to have to buy their way into this conversation.
That's crazy. But no, look, this is the National Hour, guys. All are welcome. We encourage everyone to join in.
You're right. Especially, shout out to Fugger.
Logically speaking, however, how does the SEC run through Texas when Texas has been in there 1 year and yet to win the conference?
No, Kirby, you're falling for it.
I'm just asking a logical question.
Yeah,
I'm
wait till you see Arch Manning. That's the response.
Maybe. I'm not getting emotionally involved in that. I would just like to.
Hey, we're on SEC topics. We might as well talk about them becoming their own league.
Yeah.
This is nuts.
Very interesting quote for multiple reasons.
You have a take, it sounds.
Well.
Oh, by the way, we bypassed the take today.
I know. We'll circle back. I was going to remind you about it. Yeah,
we're going to save that for the end?
Let's definitely circle back.
That's a pretty big name to have a take about, and I'm excited to hear
it. We both kind of had a take on it.
I mean, damn. That's like a historic football player to be out here to anti-ing.
I teased the take, and then Kirby, pun intended, that you'll figure out later, hit a home run with it, in my opinion.
Oh, okay. So we got a take at the end of this National Hour that's going to hit real home. But apparently the SEC is becoming their own league. This comes from, I don't even want to read. This is real reporting. Some awful announcing.
So like some,
but it's real reporting.
Awful announcing does do real reporting sometimes.
Correct.
It mostly is,
especially
known
when they're just reading quotes.
Yeah, this is a direct quote. That's why I put it in here.
All right. So this comes from Lynn Perna, who is the CEO of Turnkey ZRG, which I'm going to give you information on in just a second. He was appearing on the Varsity Podcast with Puck's John Orand. Lynn Perna described what he predicts will be the future dispute over collective bargaining with college athletes. The result? SEC schools competing in one league, everyone else competing in the other. Here comes the quote. The schools in the SEC have a lot of politics wrapped around not bargaining with a union of student athletes. There's a lot of history around right-to-work states and the boards of those SEC schools, Perna told this podcast. I don't think that the SEC will ever really be comfortable with collective bargaining with college football players, but I am very confident that schools in the Northeast, the Midwest, and all throughout the Big Ten regions and out West will land on collective bargaining as a way to create a package of work rules that govern the transfer of talent, the transfer portal, a salary floor, a salary cap, all of the things that create competitive balance in pro sports. I think that schools in the Northeast, the Midwest, and the West will wind up playing in one league that has collective bargaining, and schools in the South will play in a separate league that won't have collective bargaining. Now, a couple of questions I had right off the rip. Who is this guy? Who is this Lynn Perna guy to be out here saying these things? So I did my own research on Lynn Perna. Lynn Perna, as I said, is the CEO of Turnkey, which appears to me to be a search firm from what I can garner off of their website. Because a lot of these really rich companies have these websites that don't tell you a whole lot of stuff, but they got these real flashy words like this one right here. Since founding Turnkey, Lynn Perna has successfully managed over 1,400 executive searches. He quickly established Turnkey ZRG as a leader in the space known for its professionalism, confidentiality, and tremendous hires. Lynn Perna is an expert at understanding organizational culture, fit, and blending personalities. He regularly presents at sports award ceremonies and speaks at industry conferences. This guy helps teams find out who they're going to hire next, is what it sounds like to me. He is worth the salt with regards to talking about college sports. However, my next question, apart from who the hell is this guy, my next question is, how in the hell do you think college athletes are going to unionize? That's my biggest question.
Collective
bargaining requires unions. You miss me when you say college athletes are about to create a union.
That's what I've always questioned about when it gets brought up about how there's going to be collective bargaining between players and that there's going to be union of players when it's just not. I mean, hell, you can't even get MLB players to like completely agree for the MLB and their players to agree on anything without there being a lockout every so often. It's like you think that an entire country of 18 to 22 year olds collective bargaining and create a union for themselves is just gonna happen and go smoothly, and no, there's just no
which,
way.
By the way, the foundation of that is going to change every it's constantly yeah. changing yeah, and the base turning. Of it will change every 3 to 4 years.
Yeah, that's what my whole thing. You're telling me a group of 18 to 22 year olds are going to unionize first and foremost. Also, the nature of that union is to recycle its members every 4 years, at best, by the way. That's like safe projections. Saying an average college football player 4 years doesn't account for two people, the guy who leaves early and the guy who quits, which, by the way, is a whole hell of a lot higher than you imagine. Okay, because we're not talking about just Georgia. We're talking about the nature of college football as a whole, which every year, I would say even like a program, a Division I program like, let's say, Western Kentucky. I bet Western Kentucky has one or two guys every year that just up and quit football. They just don't play anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I know for a fact that happens. So, yeah, the idea that these guys are going to unionize, it's crazy to me. But this guy should know. This guy, again, this ain't some – this guy listens to this right here and says, that guy's an idiot. He doesn't know what the hell he's talking about.
My question with this and what I was wondering when I read this quote is, surely he's not saying that it's just going to be the 16 teams in the SEC are going to say, we have our own league now. We're going to compete for a national title. That's not how I took it. I figured that surely it would include other teams saying, we're going to go join the SEC in this, and we're going to go join this SEC league.
I want to talk to a lawyer who knows more about right-to-work states. There's a lot of history around right-to-work states and the boards of those SEC schools. The idea that they would be against collective bargaining because they are right-to-work states. I graduated with a master's of business. I don't know shit what he's talking about. He's talking about Spanish to me. That doesn't make any sense to me. I don't trust AI to look it up either.
No habla español.
No habla nerd talk. That's the way I look at that.
Oh, it's basically where employees can't be required to work in to join a union.
Okay.
Like, you're not required to be union.
Yeah, we don't have unions down here.
Mm-hmm.
Not normally. There's the electricians union here in the state, but that's about it. Unions do exist a whole hell of a lot more up north. That does check out. Mr. Perna is right on that aspect.
It makes sense. It makes sense, but it also doesn't make sense. I feel like there's a lot of assuming that.
And it's the lines of work. We don't have a lot of factories down here, do we?
I mean, there's a good amount of factories. Not as many as like your Northeast and your Midwest. But
I figure most unionized labor forces are in factory industries.
For the most part, yeah. I mean, you've got like the Actors Guild too, but.
Man, who would have thought you'd have to know about all this shit when you're talking about college football nowadays?
Not me.
I had this conversation with somebody the other day. I'm like, I'm honestly, sometimes I'm glad I went to business school, because the business aspect of college sports has never been merged more than it is right now.
Oh, it could not be more clearly a business nowadays, but yeah. It always was. It's just we've pulled back the curtains enough on things to where college football athletes are employees now. College football is a business. It's all about making money for your school. That's why you get guys like Bill Belichick and Deion Sanders in there, to where it's just about bringing in revenue from the sport. Now, winning is a large component of that, and obviously for most schools, that's the most important thing. But as long as the bottom line's good, you'll be fine.
Man, so that would basically take everybody from – that would include Clemson and – it's like all the Southern schools as he's talking about.
Mm-hmm.
If South Carolina is a right to work state, then they might avoid this and just stay in whatever super league this creates. That'd be interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Who do you think would have better football? Everybody in the South banding together,
or everybody else? Everybody in the South. Some of the best recruits up north are from the South.
That's true. But they could still leave.
They could.
That would be maybe this product down here gets worse because they're playing in a collectively bargained sport.
Maybe.
As a Southern athlete, you would want to leave and go play in that other league, wouldn't you?
I don't know.
We're getting into the weeds with this.
I know.
I did not expect this to
happen. I know, but this could be a real conversation in like whenever.
Yeah.
Several years from now.
I don't think we're ever going to get to a point where the SEC's...
It's quite a headline, though.
Where the SEC says, I'm taking my ball and I'm going home. Because we've seen time and time again, different leagues, different teams, different groups say, we're going to be trailblazers in this and do our own thing, and it never works out. Like, the Pac-12 does not exist anymore because they were trailblazers in the way that they handled their TV rights deals.
Yeah.
Obviously did not work. So, I don't believe that it's necessarily going to be something we really have to worry about, but definitely keep an eye on it.
All right. Floor is y'all's.
Do you want to
preface this?
This guy's on the wall. This guy's such a big-time college football superstar and historical figure that he made the wall.
Okay, so to explain how this all played out. So we were reading up on this list of the 25 best plays since the year 2000. And ESPN polled all their writers, and there were 25 plays put on this list. And one of the plays on here was the jump pass from Tim Tebow and the Florida Gators. And they have these videos implemented in all of them, so you get to rewatch all the plays. So Kirby and I are talking because we're talking about how we're going to go about writing the articles for this, who's taking what, whatever. And I said the jump pass being on here about made me throw up. And I go and watch it, and I'm like, this is the most overrated play in college football history. It's a better play call than it is anything else, but the actual play itself, it's just okay. Like, it's nothing fantastic.
It requires such little skill.
I was going to say.
Tight ends do it now.
Wildcat. I was going to say, like, it's one of those plays where looking back at it, like, you hear the old adage, I could have done that. I truly believe right now in my current physical form, anyone in this room could have done the jump pass.
Even AI.
Yeah.
Even AI could have done that.
He don't even have arms or legs.
He's not real.
You don't know that.
Or a gender. I shouldn't have even done that. My bad, AI. That's on me.
We're kind of really pulling back the curtain on that
one. Yeah,
I
know. My bad.
We cooked this bit. Shit.
Yeah. First night, cooked the bit.
Abort.
No,
but no.
Let it hang.
So, me and Jay Will were bantering on that, and I was like, you know what? He's right. Let me rewatch this. And rewatching this again, it is not an impressive play whatsoever. Tim Tebow made so many other great plays that should have been there. And it kind of got me thinking and down the rabbit hole. I was so bewildered by how unimpressive this play was to where it made me think and I had a knee-jerk reaction to this of, was Tim Tebow overrated? Now, before I did that, I want to give – before I give that take, I want to make sure I re-educated myself. So I watched probably – every single highlight video you can find of Tim Tebow, I'm talking full drives, complete games. I consumed probably about 2.5 hours of pure Tim Tebow media today while I was working and writing to make sure that I was spot on with giving this take and I was coming from a true place of understanding. And here's what I came up with. Tim Tebow is absolutely a college football legend. You could feel his passion, his love for the sport through the screen. I mean, I was transported back to 2008 and 2009 as a kid watching him. For God's sakes, he won 2 Nats, he won a Heisman, he broke numerous SEC records. He came back for another year when he didn't have to, in an era where leaving after 3 years was more popular than ever. He had moments like the promise, the Oklahoma locker room speech, the Florida State first down where it looks like he's covered in blood, but it's really paint. Like, he is a legend, period. I'm not questioning that. Now, after watching that 2.5 hour films, though, there are some criticisms, though. He had a very elongated release that would almost exactly be a much bigger problem today than it was back then. He didn't layer the football very well. The caliber of athletes that he was playing against were very different. I mean, prime example of this, his teammate Brandon Spikes, a second round draft pick in the NFL draft, ran a 5 second 40. So athletes were a little different back then. And my God, defenses did not know what to do with quarterback power back in the day. I mean, you would think a wrapping guard and a lead blocker was the new invention. This was also about the time when the Wildcat got really big in the NFL. So it made sense as to why Tebow was having success. So here's the conclusion that I've come to on Mr. Tebow. I'm old enough to remember watching him. Most everyone in this room is old enough to remember watching him and certainly holds him in a high regard, and they should. He was a legend for his time. But we're also in an era where basically every college football player on a roster this year wasn't even in kindergarten when Tim Tebow was playing college football. Some like were like 2 years old, which is why we're about a generation or two away from Tim Tebow getting a Babe Ruth treatment. Now, what the Babe Ruth treatment is, for those who don't know, when a player's legendary status is recognized, but their athletic abilities are diminished. Now, I'm not saying that should happen, but Michael Jordan played with plumbers, Babe Ruth would suck today in today's MLB, Muhammad Ali would get knocked out by any heavyweight in this class. We've heard it all before. I think pretty soon the evolution of fans is going to turn into Tim Tebow was a glorified tight end that could throw really far. Is that correct? Probably not, but good luck convincing the next generation of college football fans that's not the case.
Boy, you're not going to like watching Gunnar Stockton play football.
That's what I was about to say, and that's what also my point was. Where's Gunnar Stockton on these top 30 rankings this year of quarterbacks? Where's Gunnar Stockton in the hype train or whatever? Like, now, Gunnar Stockton is a smaller build than Tim Tebow, but a guy that's not afraid to run the football, will stick his nose anywhere. The team builds around him, has fiery passion, loves the sport, no drama, all this has an elongated release that we've talked about. Like, a lot of comparisons from Gunnar Stockton can be drawn to Tim Tebow 15 years ago, and no one's really high on Gunnar Stockton right now. So, now, I'm not saying that Gunnar Stockton is Tim Tebow, but I think that history is not going to be kind to the athleticism of Tim Tebow, which is unfortunate, because watching him, like I said, living through it, he was a larger-than-life character. But the people that didn't watch it aren't going to understand, and he's probably 5 to 10 years away from someone going, yeah, but Tim Tebow, he was just a slow tight end that could run over a linebacker and throw really far.
You get enough Miller Lights and the right dog fan, they already got that take.
I mean low-key.
I don't, and I think that the take is being misinterpreted. Of it's not disrespect to Tebow, because it's not discrediting anything Tebow
did.
Yeah,
I mean, Babe Ruth is.
It's not saying he's not worthy of being considered one of the greatest college quarterbacks of all time, or diminishing anything he accomplished at Florida or anything like that. He's still one of the greatest of all time in college football. But it's not crazy to say that 15 years down the road, if Tim Tebow was implemented into college football today, could it have looked different in his career? Yeah, I mean, it absolutely could have, because, yes, people do it with athletes all the time.
Oh, look, Tim Tebow, again, legend. He played 15 years ago, and it shows.
I don't know. The whole take makes me feel uncomfortable.
I understand. And, look,
you can make an argument he probably should have won two Heismans.
You could.
Sure.
You absolutely could. And
you
again,
could argue Herschel Walker needed three.
Like, I'm all for the, oh, his touchdown records bullshit, all of them were one-yard tutties. Like, I'm all for the hatred, but we love football, and we love college football. Mm-hmm. That's what we love. And there are a few people who exude college football,
yes,
more than
and
Tim.
I hope I displayed that in my laying of this out.
Yeah.
He is one of a kind in that regard, and will forever be held as someone who, and deserves to be held in that regard. But there's going to be a group of kids 5 to 10 years from now that go back and watch Tim Tebow highlights and go, that's it?
That guy?
That's who we said is one of the greatest quarterbacks of all time. That guy sucks.
To that extent, that's a disrespectful young teenager. That kid sucks.
But it's the same argument as Michael Jordan played with plumbers.
No, it's not. That's the like mid-80s and early 90s. There were still like real – like you mentioned Brandon Spikes. Like Brandon Spikes went on to play like 5, 6, 7 years with the Patriots and like won a couple Super Bowls, I'm pretty sure. It's not like not a bad football. It's just a different era of football.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But that's what
it
I'm
looks
saying.
Different.
That's what I'm saying, though. Yeah. And the idea is that he's not going to translate well, and probably wouldn't. But that's going to be a criticism used against him, which is the same that gets used for Babe Ruth, Michael Jordan, Wayne Gretzky gets this sometimes. Like any legendary boxers, like, yeah, but they get smoked by anyone in today's. So it's where we're headed.
Brooks is a LeBron simp. Don't talk to him about the GOAT.
I can tell you, we've had discussions off air that he's kind of waning off of that.
Yeah, we're fading on that. You keep faking injuries when you lose, buddy. You keep showing up after a knockout loss with the ice pack on the knee, limping to the microphone, and I'm more apropos to lean on my daddy's side that keeps calling you a flopper, bro. That's unfortunate.
Now you're getting accused of saying Larry Bird's a plumber.
Again.
Local hour.
The people talk, man.
Local hour. We got a hold of the hour coming up right now.